It may be difficult for you to put it all together, but there is another highlight of my radar career in the early days. And that I was at Edgar, Ontario, just north of Toronto, during the Avro Arrow test phase. And I think I brought I just wanted to set it out. I'll do that in a minute. The Avro Arrow, when it did its supersonic runs, had to be monitored by radar for a number of reasons. Let's say the aircraft had a catastrophic structural failure or something while it was going supersonic. You would have an immediate position on where that happened. Moreover, you had to keep it away from other air traffic and from population centers on the ground. So they would design a track that did that, and then we didn't get to talk to it, to the pilot. We heard him. He could hear us, but we didn't talk to him because he was talking to a test director in Toronto. And there were five supersonic test flights. I controlled all five of the Arrow test flights. I didn't control, I flight followed, tracked five of them while on a hotline with the test director. So he would let me know when it was going airborne. I would let him know when I had contact with it and that we were tracking it successfully. And then I would tell him it's clear of other traffic, there's no traffic in the vicinity. You're clear to proceed with the test. And then the test would be to go supersonic from 35,000 feet in a climb, often through 50,000 feet. The first five aircraft had J-47 engines. The last aircraft, test six that I was to monitor, I was on that day, and he called up and he said the flight's delayed. Takeoff is delayed. Often in the first five, you'd get delays, and they'd be because of some kind of like a brake problem or a hydraulic leak or something. And they'd get that fixed, and the aircraft would eventually fly. This time, you'd say there's another delay. And the delays went on for quite some time. I'm not sure how long. And finally, he called back. He said, the flight's canceled. I said, is that just for today? Because usually that day we set up for the next day's flying. When do you think the next flight will be? Would it be tomorrow? I was assuming a fairly serious mechanical snag. He said, no, it looks like it will never fly. And that was the day Diefenbaker ordered them to cancel the program. I wish they had flown it anyway. The performance would have been phenomenal. It was phenomenal with the J-47 engine, with the Iroquois, which was, I don't know whether it was a lot lighter than the J-47 and had a whole bunch more thrust. The thrust to weight ratio with the two Iroquois engine was almost 1 to 1 in the Arrow. That means it had as much thrust as its weight. Now that ratio is not normal. It's way above it, and it would have been quite fascinating to see how fast it would go. But we tracked it in those days with the J-47 engine up to Mach 2 and measured it over 50,000 feet. And it would go supersonic in a climb. So it was a phenomenal airplane. And they couldn't get anybody to buy it, I guess. And Diefenbaker, there. Well, that's a mouse pad. Just so you can remember what it looked like.
That's awesome. Speaking of your experiences as a controller, were there any other experiences that you had as a weapons controller that you can elaborate to, or?
When I was based in North Bay, one of our squadrons from Bagotville was selected, won the competition within the Canadian fighter squadrons to represent Canada at the William Tell Worldwide Rocket Meet in Tyndall, out of Tyndall Air Force Base. We as a control team, I was an intercept director, to put it in American terms, and I had a technician. We had a weapons director who hands the fighters off to us and his technician. And then there was another intercept director, a friend of mine named Hank Henry, and his technician. And we formed the control team for our fighter squadron. Now, the Voodoos had not had their fire control systems upgraded as the Americans had. We had not bought into a contract for continuous electronic upgrades. So we were at a disadvantage. But nonetheless, we controlled well and did a good job, and it was a great experience. It's kind of exciting because we got to go down to Tyndall to meet with the air crew and that sort of thing. When you're based in the States, you're eligible, depending on state law, to have tax-free liquor. Apparently, Alabama didn't allow that, so the Canadians based in Montgomery could not partake of it. The liquor was usually ordered from the embassy in Washington because they could legally transport it, so they would ship it out to us. When I was in Michigan, you used to have to get a license to import tax-free, and they had to guarantee it would only be used by the Canadians. So we had a little canteen thing that where we dispense the liquor sales. What happened in Montgomery as a result of this thing, the Canadians wanted to host a cocktail party for the Americans. And there's only a half dozen of us. So they said, we can't afford to do this at normal liquor prices. Do you think we could get some diplomatic liquor? Well, they had some in Tyndall, in Florida, in the Panhandle, but not in Montgomery. So I owned an almost brand new Galaxy 500 XL two-door hardtop Ford with a 390 horsepower engine. So I fancied myself a rum runner, and I ran the liquor up from Tyndall into Montgomery, making sure I didn't go over the speed limit or too far under the speed limit to gain any suspicion from the state troopers, because if they had opened my trunk, there were several cases of liquor. That was one risk I took, but it's not really anything to do with NORAD or air defense. It's just one of the shenanigans of the day. So you can put that in or not. I may not get arrested.
Sounds great. Just to further go into the administration of the NORAD bases, were there any particular experiences that were notable? Or
in that paperwork I gave you, you'll see that many of the bases in the early days of the Pine Tree Line west of Falconbridge, Ontario, were all American built and manned. Okay? Up until the cancellation of the Arrow and the purchasing of the Bomark, and in exchange for taking the Bomark, the Americans wanting to put Bomarks into Canada, how did that work? Sorry, got that wrong. I'm trying to think of the history. In exchange for taking over manning of the Western radars that the Americans, the radar site names which you may come across, Kapuskasing, Armstrong, Pagua, Sioux Lookout, Beausejour, Yorkton, Alsask, were all American. Baldy Hughes, Punsey Mountain, were all American manned. In exchange for us taking over and manning all of those radar sites with Canadian forces, the Americans gave us the Voodoo fighters. They wanted us to have the Voodoo fighters, but nobody was prepared to buy a fighter. So we actually got the fighter. We had to pay for the support, I think, eventually. But that's a very important factor in the development of the air defense system and how it worked. For us to get a supersonic first line fighter, we took over the operating of the radar sites. The ones in the east, northeast, which I already addressed as the Americans having closed, we didn't take over any of them except Goose Bay and I guess Gander, but that fact may be wrong. We may have already been manning Gander, I'm not sure. But anyway, at least Goose Bay had been American manned and we took it over, closed all the rest, let the Americans close the rest. But interestingly, sites like Beaver Bank and Sydney, Nova Scotia radar sites and Barrington, Nova Scotia were actually American built and funded, but they were Canadian manned. So they actually were paying, they paid to put those sites there, but we agreed to man them. So we were under what they called USAF. There was actually an order in council and a congressional funding thing that they used to fund repairs and maintenance of those sites. So that's part of the administration situation. Other than that, it was just the normal business of managing any small company, if you like. You had the usual problems of vandalism, possible personnel problems related to alcohol abuse, all those little things that happen when you have a lot of people under your control. There's often sometimes, not so much on the radar sites, but where, say, a young airman can't get married quarters and the cost of living is high, like here in Victoria, they can be living at the poverty level on their salaries. So commanders have that kind of responsibility to see that the welfare of the troops and the family. And then all of the usual problems, if you've got married quarters on your site, you have your usual percentage of people, just as in civilian life, that might be wife abusers or wives that are irresponsible and don't properly look after their kids. Not much of that, because you've selected from a more elite group of people, so they're not like the average civilian population. They're generally, just to get through their training, you've selected a pretty upstanding guy, but nonetheless, there were a few problems. And that's, I guess, an admin problem in a sense. The rest of it was like maintenance and funding and whatnot.
I believe, and just to go back a bit, you already elaborated to your experiences at Colorado, but is there anything further on your experiences in Colorado that you could elaborate on, or?
No. From a personal point of view and family point of view, it was one of the nicest places. Colorado Springs sits at 6,200 feet on the crest of Pikes Peak. Pikes Peak itself had the Pike National Forest and the National Forest Trails, which included the Bar Trail, which went from the base to the top. It was, the base was 6,000 feet and the top was 14,000 feet. So it was a 13-mile trail with an 8,000 foot elevation change. So that afforded my sons and I, one was in grade 9, one was in, my daughter was in high school, my son was in grade 9, my youngest son was in elementary school. We used to hike that when I had days off on weekends. And just the living there was really nice. both of the officers, the two that preceded me, had each had 4 years there. The assignment was two. But they are both told, I had talked to the guy who had been there earlier and the guy I replaced, and he said, no problem getting an extension. You just put in, after you've been here a year, ask for a 1 year extension. They'll usually grant it. And then at the end of that, your second year, ask for a fourth and they'll usually give it to you. And that had happened to the two guys I replaced. The military adamantly refused to extend my posting, and my family were quite upset. My daughter in particular, because she was in grade 12. The standard of the schooling there was very high. They were accredited to Ivy League universities. That's how high the local high school standards were, partly because Colorado Springs had the Air Force Academy, had Fort Carson Military Base, and had NORAD Cheyenne Mountain Complex. It now has Space Command. All those officers and their wives want their children to have a university degree. They want the high schools, and they funded the high schools accordingly with the bond issues and so on to be very high standard. And my daughter just didn't want to leave. And I ended up being, the reason I couldn't stay is I had been selected for Staff College in Toronto. And that's a career move you don't refuse, or you don't get promoted beyond major. So my daughter just begged to stay, and we had an American friend who we actually gave our daughter away to, because the tuition at, for example, at University of Manitoba was about $400 for a standard Bachelor of Science course in psychology or something like that, or in nursing. At Dalhousie, it might have been a little higher, $600 or $800. They wanted, this is 1972, it would have been the 72-73 semester, about $1,200 for tuition for a foreign student in high school. And I said to my daughter, I said, that's almost 3 years tuition at a university in Canada at the time, living at home, you know. And I said, I can't afford to blow what we've saved to send you to college on 1 year high school. You'll have to come back to Toronto. So I'm telling this sad story to the administrator at the school's board. And she said, well, where is she going to live if you leave her here? I said, just down the street from the school, about four blocks. I said, our close friends, an American major and his wife, live there, and we've known them for years. And said she could board with them. She says, oh, she'll be in our school district. She won't have to pay any tuition if they adopt her, if they become her legal guardians. So I signed my 16-year-old daughter away to a couple of Americans. And I never did get her back because she reached the age of majority before that was rescinded. So they're her last parents of record. That's what happens in the military life, those things you have to do to manage. The good news for my son went to... we lived in North York, and he went to A.Y. Jackson, which was a brand new high school, well equipped. Two of the courses, a biology course and a chemistry course he had taken in grade 9 in Colorado Springs, weren't offered till grade 11 in North York. And he was given credit for those two courses up front as he entered grade 11 in North York. No, he was entering he did 8 and 9 in Colorado, so he was entering grade 10, but they gave him credit for two grade 11 courses. So he got a big jump on graduation credits right there. That's a little personal, it's nothing to do with air defense, but it's a reality of moving around a lot. We moved geographically, changed locations, 21 times in my first 30 years in the service. Sometimes we were as short as 9 months or 11 months at a place. then the poor kids would have to move. Just made a bunch of friends and now they're gone.
I can imagine. And I can imagine moving up to the Northern Posting, probably.
Northern Posting was difficult because no families, of course. I positioned my wife, and that was a mistake in retrospect. In Monday morning quarterbacking, should have left her in Winnipeg, where I went back and forth in order to catch a commercial flight to Vancouver to see her. I was out twice in a year. And each time I had to spend money for a commercial trip from Winnipeg to Vancouver. Had I left her in Winnipeg, there would be no cost when I arrived. And if the Northern flight was canceled, as it sometimes was, like one time I was supposed to leave on a Wednesday midnight for a 12-hour trip to my site, and it was delayed for 2 days. So I was in Winnipeg 2 extra days when I could have been home if she had lived there. But it was hard on my wife. My daughter became very ill at one point. She couldn't swallow. She had a very sore throat, but they couldn't see anything. And they eventually hospitalized her and finally discovered a severe abscess, which was closing off her windpipe and her esophagus. And when they finally got it operated to drain it, and the abscess was all internal, not external, it had bacteria in there that hadn't been classified yet. My wife always blames the fact that she went with her sister down to Vancouver East Side to the Army and Navy secondhand store and figured she picked up a foreign bug there. And so I'm on the dew line and the mail went to Winnipeg. Then it was flown by contract aircraft to our site. It took about 2 weeks to get mail from Vancouver to me. So I get a letter from my, and she has no, there's no electronic means of contact. I could call her infrequently by convincing a radar site at Blaine, Washington to give me a commercial line to North Vancouver. And then I would pay the long distance charge. We reverse the charges. That was strictly illegal because the contract with the telephone companies is that you wouldn't use a military line to go part of the distance and then take a commercial line the rest of the way. You had to go commercial all the way. You're stealing our business by doing that. I explained to the people at Blaine, I have no commercial telephone. I'm not taking business away from anybody. I'm on the Audubon system, which is now the worldwide internet. That's the big change. That was handed off to the telephone companies because I could call anywhere in the world on the Audubon system, as you can call anywhere in the world on the internet. So I would call Blaine on the Audubon and then get them to connect me. And I say, I'm not taking money away from the telephone company. I'm giving it to them because there is no commercial line between me and you where I am. I'm that remote. Anyway, so I get a letter from my wife that says, Kim is very ill. She's in the hospital. The doctor said, unless they can find what's causing the temperature and the fever, he's not sure she'll survive. It was one of those rare situations. That's the letter I get. I immediately call Blaine, Washington, and explain it's a medical emergency for the family, get hold of my wife and say, how's Kim? What's happening? Where's Kim? I think was my question. Oh, she's in school. What? I just read your letter that said she's dying. And she said, but that was 4 weeks ago. Well, 2 weeks ago. She said, they found it, they drained it, they gave her the antibiotics, they kicked in, and she's fine. That's the reality of living remotely. Now, I want to talk something else about the Cold War. You may want to include this. I was on a Strategic Air Command base. The bombers flew in and out of KI Soyer. The tankers had a strategic ops plan that took them to places like either Turkey or Spain. A KC-135 tanker crew would go to work in the morning saying, "See you at supper, honey. I'm just doing circuits today." They would get a bug out, as it was codenamed, order. The squadron would leave. They weren't allowed to call their wife to say they were leaving. They weren't allowed to contact them anytime they were away, and sometimes they were gone for 3 months. And the wife's sitting at home not knowing where her husband's gone, because she's never allowed to know what his deployment position is or where in the world. And then he shows up home 3 months later. As a result, there was a lot of family difficulties among the Strategic Air Command families. There was one lady, definitely to be pitied, not vilified, who spent a lot of time in the officers' club because she was lonely. And I mean, I'm not here to say that she was up to anything nefarious, but she was there and often drinking too much. And visiting flyers might be trying to date her, you know, that sort of thing. But that's just a manifestation of just being lonely and frustrated, I think. So that's the reality of the Cold War, with people like that. In my case, our Navy guys were much the same, but at least their wives knew that they were on board a ship, and they could send messages back and forth. You know, they could do regular communications. Nowadays, it's not bad at all because you can FaceTime or Skype. But in the Arctic, I could talk to her. The commander at Blaine said, "Try to limit it." So maybe once a month, I would phone her, and we'd have a short conversation just to make sure everything. The rest of the time was just letters, and they took a couple of weeks to recycle. You know, I'd get a letter and write her, and it'd take 2 weeks for her to get it, and so she had the emergency medical with my daughter. She herself became very ill. She was a 110-pound skinny redhead at the time, with three kids, one in grade six, one in grade four, and one in kindergarten. She had to get him back and forth to kindergarten. There was no bus service, way up in Lynn Canyon. And he had an accident in the backyard, in the back lane, crashed his bike, cut his forehead open, and that sort of, all those little things, you know, that you don't have a husband, and then you go to bed alone at night and you have nobody to talk to about the day's problems and the frustrations. Military wives had it pretty tough, I think. Mine only for a year. The rest of the time it was just temporary duty. You know, you'd go away for maybe a course which was 2 weeks long, or a course that was 2 months long. Most of these small courses, like management courses, would be 2 weeks. Staff college was a full year, but because we were based in the United States, she had to accompany me, so I got authorization to move her. So she lived in Toronto. So unlike many of the guys who lived in North Bay or Ottawa, they left their wives there while they went to staff college and commuted every weekend. I did that when I was in staff school, but staff school is only 3 months long, staff college is 10. So that's the reality of a military wife. And Jean, in some locations, worked, and in other locations, couldn't. She was a school music teacher, licensed in Newfoundland, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia, and Ontario. But most of the time, she could only get fill-in work, what do you call it, a substitute teaching. And except in New Brunswick, she had a 2-year stint as a full-time music teacher. And I think in Newfoundland and Gander, at one point she taught school for a full year when a teacher was on maternity leave or something like that. That's the reality, though. She gave up a career to marry me, in effect.
Indeed. That definitely seems hard on the family.
Nowadays, it seldom happens. I'll give you an anecdotal thing. A colonel I knew who was a construction engineering officer, and he took over. He was posted, he was promoted and posted to Ottawa, and his wife had a better job than him. I mean, she was earning more money than his military lieutenant colonel's salary. He was promoted to full colonel, but her money was still better than he was going to earn as a full colonel. So he resigned his commission, gave up his career, fortunately got a very good job as in the Manitoba has a housing project, for low income housing. And I think he took over all the management of all the Manitoba housing complexes. So I think he probably got a pretty good salary doing that. But that's another reality of today. Now they say people just, the wives often have as good a job as the husband, or at least as much salary. And they get posted and they say, let's not do it. In my day, you never considered it. The poor old wife was a camp follower, and she went when you went, sort of thing.
Then that's awesome, and very interesting. Just to move on to a different topic here, you mentioned you participated in several intercepts.
I'll just give you one intercept, of course, was the Bear D. Most of the rest of them were exercise, either during exercises or day-to-day things. I and another controller at St. Margaret's, which was a manual radar, and you use, and it's a planned position indicator. It has a rotating sweep, like the old-fashioned radars. And I just want to do you lay, this is the primary one here. You lay that on your plan position indicator, and you get a, you have a target. So you lay this on your target heading, and then you steer your aircraft to bring it into one of the lines, and then vector it. So the interceptor's coming this way, you turn down this line and this way, and the target's going this way. And then you call off the ranges. You set this up, you can change the expansion on your display, zoom in and zoom out to make it match the lines on your handy dandy. We didn't use this a lot, but this you could, it's just a circular computer where you would calculate, you put your target true airspeed on it, and then you figure out what your aircraft has to do and that sort of thing. Normally you use control two, a section of two against a target. At St. Margaret's, if we were on what they call level two training, and this was before it became a Buick site, it was just a radar site for a Buick two facility in Topsham Air Force Station, Maine. And when they were looking after the Bangor sector, which we were a part of, they ended up with too many fighter squadrons for their number of controllers they had. So we took we had 416 squadron all to ourselves. So we trained with them daily, virtually. And sometimes a manual controller is really working hard if he's got three fighters under control. But this guy, Ed Chenier, and I, I remember one day they had 10 fighters they wanted to put up, and we only had two controllers. We said, well, we'll take them all. So we each had 10 fighters and two targets to look after. You have to remember that while you're doing this, you've got to keep them separated from all civilian traffic at the same time. So you're watching five airplanes on as blips and making sure they stay at least 5 miles, I think it was, away from any civilian blips, and setting them up. Now, running a specific pattern, isn't as hard as it sounds, because if you were trying to run five interceptors against three or four different targets, that's very difficult. In SAGE, to become an expert, that's an automated system, you had to be able to control five fighters against two targets. But the computer's steering them most of the time, so you just had to kind of keep a close look. In manual, you're steering them all the time. So we could only run against one target, but that was a highlight of my, it was amazing. The pilots called up as soon as they got in the ground, God, you guys were busy. And we were pretty proud. That was a highlight day, just for fun. Let me jump to a later phase in my life. When I went to North Bay as a lieutenant colonel, waiting to take over as senior staff officer, ground environment. This was from the site of St. Margaret's. They delayed the move of the senior staff officer, ground environment section from Air Defense Command or group to Air Command for 1 year. So I ended up in North Bay for a year instead of going to Winnipeg with the group. And I became the director of the control center. I ran the control center. That in the States was a full colonel position, in Canada was a lieutenant colonel position. As an extra duty, we had a school, what did we call our school? Aircraft Control and Warning School? Anyway, it was the basic course for training intercept controllers. And the fail rate was off the clock. They were failing more than 50% of the young officers coming in to take the training. So the chief of staff operations directed me to do a staff study and write up a staff study as to why this was happening. It was very, very difficult to get a handle on it, but what was happening is most of the young instructors were very proud of the fact that they had succeeded as intercept directors or controllers. And they set a very high standard. And I think they also, because they were so proud of the fact that they could do this and do it well, or they wouldn't have been instructors, they seemed to overemphasize to the new student how dangerous it was, you know, how stressful. And I think they got the student so uptight that he couldn't function. But it's hard to accuse, because that's an emotional thing and not a specific thing. So I had to be very careful in my paper and in my words. The way I explained it to my boss and to the commanding officer of the school, I said, you know, when I became an intercept director, I was a good airborne interceptor guy. I taught my course. It was fun running against targets, you know, doing this kind of thing. I went on to a PPI, planned position indicator, and started running intercepts, and I found it fun. When I got onto SAGE, it was like operating a pinball machine. You're aware that if you make a mistake, you could kill somebody, you know, run two aircraft together. I was actually a standards officer monitoring a trainee running an intercept when the fighter cracked, I'll explain how it crashed later, but the fighter was lost and both crew were killed. And that's really hard on the intercept director running the course. I was monitoring because he was a trainee. And so anyway, it is, all right, the school had a very high failure rate. So I had to start by kind of watching what they were doing, interviewing all of the instructors, some of whom were senior NCOs, some of whom were young officers. And the main factor I found was many of them were commissioned from the ranks. They were not officers coming in from other trades, but they were air defense techs with a lot of experience and clearly top of their field, and then got commissioned as air weapons controllers and took the training, and they were very good at what they did. But they were also very proud of what they did. And I think it enhanced their feeling about what they were, what they had accomplished, by making it, in their own mind, a very difficult job that I've mastered. And then they seem to have, and that was my finding, imparted that idea of how difficult this job is. They stressed the difficulty of becoming an air weapons controller. And also reinforced that by warning the student that if you make a mistake, you're going to kill somebody. And that's just a little too simplistic. You can make all kinds of mistakes without killing somebody in that environment, because there's a pilot and a navigator aboard that airplane that has responsibility. There's a pilot and usually a co-pilot on the target aircraft if you're practicing intercepts, and they have a responsibility to avoid collisions and whatnot. If the problem with the aircraft becomes mechanical, the controller does have to take over, give emergency directions back to the pilot's airfield, but he also has navigation equipment on board that can get him there also. But generally, because he's under your control, and the responsibility, as it was in that day, was that you could fly anywhere you liked with among civilian traffic, as long as you kept 5 nautical miles distance from these other targets. So yes, you're looking at this big display and you've got all sorts of aircraft around it, and you're trying to steer your aircraft towards a selected target, either a practice one or an unknown. And at the same time, you have to avoid other air traffic by 5 miles. So it does take a big span of attention, and I'm not trying to underestimate how difficult that can be in a heavy trafficked environment. But it seemed to me they overemphasized just how dangerous it was, forgetting that there's at least if you're controlling 2 aircraft, there's 4 sets of eyes there, plus your own eyes, plus your tech. So anyway, they did have the students in an absolute state of almost panic when they had to sit down to run an intercept. And I felt that that was causing them to make mistakes, not being relaxed at what they were doing and confident in what they were doing, but afraid of what they were doing. And I hesitated to lay blame in a circumstance like that, because it's all psychological. It's not something you can prove. I can't prove that you're scaring this student to death with your attitude and your what you impart to him. But I suspect that, you know. So the finding was that I think a few of the people actually got transferred from being an instructor. You needed people as instructors who were quite calm and so good at what they did that they didn't treat it as a big deal. you know, just quiet confidence in what you're capable of doing. And the school went on to survive. It's all different now. We call it the Department of Transport anymore. It's Nav Canada. Does all the training of both air traffic controllers and air weapons controllers for their basic ability to use the new system. The new air defense control system is the same system that the air traffic controllers use. So all the symbologies and everything in the way you use the computer, the way you interpret it, is all the same. Then the air weapons controllers go into the Air Force environment and learn to run intercepts, but they already know the system. They could actually split and be air traffic controllers or air weapons controllers. So what I did was applicable only to the SAGE system, not the new system, and applicable only to the students going through our system at that time, which was the late 70s, 1977. Subsequently, the school continued running until this new air defense system was installed and ran well. I knew most of the commanding officers. Some of them retired in this area. They were all very dedicated and sensible people. But these young CFRs, as they're called, commissioned from the ranks, I think their own pride in what they had accomplished made them in their mind and make the job more difficult than it really was. And they imparted that feeling to their students, and that almost they imparted a fear instead of a confidence. And so many of them quit as well. Some failed, others quit. Do you want to shut down now for a minute? Well, to explain the task that a weapons controller had using the SAGE system, he had a large 15-inch display, which was made up of digitally produced target tracks that came in from radar sites digitally. He also had computer-generated symbology, they called it, which was alphanumeric symbols attached to the radar tracks. Now, the symbols would identify a track number, and if you knew who it was, like Air Canada Flight 173, it would also include the identification. On your fighter aircraft, the symbology, alphanumeric symbology, would describe the aircraft call sign and give you a direction and speed that he was doing at the time, and you could assign an altitude. You entered most of this data by way of a very large button display board, probably well over 100 buttons, each with an individual function. The controller's job then was to sit at a scope when he saw the radar track appear of the fighter, say, coming out of the airbase he was monitoring. He would use a light pen to pair his symbology with that radar track. The computer would then keep it together, and if the computer failed in that, he had to monitor it and reassociate it, because the actual radar track could turn port or starboard, and the symbology might become disassociated. So that was one of his tasks, to keep his alphanumeric symbology associated with the radar track. His other job then was, if he wanted to run an intercept with those two fighters against, say, a practice target, he had control of the target also. He would pair symbology with that, and then all the computer intercept was symbology against symbology, not against radar tracks. So if they became disassociated, the symbology could go together, but the tracks might not. So the actual aircraft would not get together. So his job as he sat there was to keep his alphanumeric symbology associated with the actual radar track. At the same time, he had to make sure that those actual radar tracks did not interfere with any other air traffic or get within 5 nautical miles of other air traffic. That was all part of his monitoring task. Once he had control of the fighters, and if he was controlling the target as well, he had full air traffic control, if you like, of those aircraft. He could take them anywhere he liked. He had no restrictions except those that were posted. Like, you don't go into the Toronto Aerodrome control area. You don't go into any major airport's aerodrome control area. You had to stay off of airways, prescribed airways that aircraft were flying. So you just fly in between them. Later, as it became more and more difficult to maintain this separation, they actually would sanitize an area in which you could run your intercept and keep all other air traffic out of it. The air traffic control people would do that for you. That was the case in the United States. It was never the case in Canada up until the new system came in. While we were in SAGE, we could fly a fighter anywhere we liked, as long as we kept out of the aerodrome control and airways areas. And so a young student had all of that to think about. He had all this alphanumeric symbology to learn and understand. He had all of these actions. He had to understand how to pair the symbology one against the other, how to identify his fighters. He also had to steer his fighters, bringing them back. Usually the pickup range of a in those days before ILS, instrument landing systems, they used ground control approach radar, which was a controller sitting at a scope on the ground. So your job generally with a fighter was to, you're at 40,000 feet coming in from the west to North Bay, let's say. You have an 8 mile handoff point off the end of the runway where GCA could pick him up. So you give him his descent, you keep him clear of all air traffic as he's descending. You position him, you separate your fighters so that if GCA is specified 10 mile separation, then you have your fighters 10 miles apart. They come over the point and you say, North Bay GCA, I have Alpha Kilo 2-1 ready for handoff. And Alpha Kilo 2-1, good day. And he'll call the GCA, GCA take over. So in bad weather, you actually had to do a lot of the approach for the fighters. So while that's happening, you might have as many as 4, and they might all have to return at the same time. So you have to get them lined up for the GCA in those days. Remember, this is history. if you've got 4 fighters under control and they are not going, the term was bingo fuel, at the same time, you might be running an intercept with this pair while you're trying to recover this pair, unless you can hand it off to another controller who's not busy and say, would you take my fighters into the GCA approach? And if it's good weather, the pilot could take over himself and do his own recovery. But only in bad weather. It was, so you can see that it's a complex job with your attention separated in different geographical areas within the range of your scope. For example, our radars gave us a view north of Lake Superior. The radar chain was along through Armstrong and Kapuskasing. So 250 miles nominally north of that, you could see. So we're looking at an area at least 300 miles north of the north shore of Lake Superior. And from Sault Ste. Marie, all the way to Duluth, roughly the whole of Lake Superior area, and all the way south down to Chicago and Milwaukee and Detroit, where other sectors took over. So it's a big area to monitor, and you could be flying in any of it. Usually we were running north because there's less traffic north, and not much. There was airways that crossed Lake Superior from Lakehead to Sault Ste. Marie and then down to Toronto. So you had to be careful crossing those airways and so on. So that kind of describes what a controller has to do. He has to find the little pip that's his radar, a digital radar indicator of the actual target or the actual fighters. He has to pair them with alphanumeric symbology. Then he takes control and can steer them around the sky either verbally or by just pairing the symbologies together. The computer takes over and sends data link information, which steers, and the aircraft takes its hands off the stick except the throttle, and it actually steers the aircraft. The computer sending messages to change headings, to change speed. It'll send a message to change speed, heading, and altitude. The pilot has to jockey his throttles. If it tells him to change altitude and he has to climb, it'll give him a speed that he has to set, but he has to adjust the throttle. The computer didn't do that. Computer steered him left and right and put him into a descent or a climb. That's all about the task of doing a SAGE weapons director's job.
That's great. And actually, you mentioned previously that there was one instance where an aircraft was lost, but could you elaborate on that?
Yes, it was during an air defense exercise in Sault Ste. Marie Air Defense Sector. The fighters were Voodoos out of, I think, Wurtsmouth Air Force Base in Detroit. And they were running against exercise targets, so the targets wouldn't be under control of the intercept director. The intercept director would have had control of two fighters. The intercept was against a high altitude target, and the computer selected what they called a snap-up intercept. And this is where the target, perhaps at 40,000 feet, and the fighter goes in at 25,000 feet and in a head-on attack. And at the last, the fighter pilot takes over the intercept. He's got the target. Then his airborne intercept computer takes control of the intercept, heads him directly towards the target, and at the right moment puts him into a steep climb, which would lob his MB-1 ballistic rocket in the direction of the target and time it to explode as it got to the target. It's not actually a guided missile, it's a ballistic rocket. When he goes into that snap-up mode, the Voodoo aircraft had a high-flying tail at the top of the vertical stabilizer. If you went into too tight a turn, left or right, or too tight a pull-up, the tail dropped out of the airflow, and the aircraft went into what they called a pitch-up. And in effect, the whole airframe became ballistic. It was no longer controlled because the tailplane, either the horizontal or the vertical stabilizer, is now not in the airflow. There's no recovery from a pitch up, as far as I know, except to pop the drag chute, which pulls the tail. If the drag chute doesn't tear off, it may pull the tail back up into the airflow. So now the pilot's got both horizontal stabilizers and vertical stabilizer airflow over the tail plane. Apparently the fighter, I think it was the lead fighter on the attack, going into this pitch up, shortly after he took Judy, which means he has control of the intercept, we lost contact with him. And the assumption was he went into a pitch up and failed to recover. And the aircraft was lost, and they never did find him. He would have been over the northern part of either the south eastern part of Lake Superior or the northern part of Lake Michigan. And he probably crashed in Superior, which is a very deep lake. And I never heard whether they found the wreckage or not. The controller I was monitoring, I was a safety instructor and a training instructor, was a student. I never did hear the follow-up, how he felt. We tried to reassure him that everything had gone correctly up till then. He had done nothing that would have, it would be the pilot's responsibility following the call of duty not to fly his airplane outside of his parameters. In a voodoo, to prevent pitch up, if a pilot tried to turn too sharply, he got a horn as he was approaching that risk turn, too hard a turn, he got a horn first. Then if he continued to pull too hard and the tailplane's getting out of the flow, he got a pusher. It actually pushed his stick forward to slow the rate of turn or slow the rate of pull up. So if he was riding horn and pusher to the limit, he may have lost control. There's a certain point where this aircraft, and then there's turbulence and bad weather and disorientation possibly, you never know. And that's about the end of that particular thing. It just shows one of the risks of both for a controller and for the air crew flying in tough environments. There's one other aspect of running intercepts. Our sector was part of a Sky Shield exercise, which was the first and only since time that all air traffic was grounded in North America so that we could run a huge air defense exercise. So all civilian air traffic, and it never happened again until 9/11 when they grounded all air traffic. For different reasons. All the other sectors within North America, except ours, the targets running against them were flying profiles that intelligence thought the Russians would fly. I don't know whether I told you this earlier or not. So a B-52, pretending it's a Russian aircraft, was required to fly within the parameters of what they thought a bear aircraft could do. If it was a B-58 Hustler, he had to fly the parameters that the known Russian supersonic bomber could do. He couldn't go higher than the bomber was capable of or believed to be capable of, or faster. So everywhere else, and the tactics used, flying in high, low, or using jamming, were based on what intelligence thought the Russians would do against us. In our sector, Strategic Air Command planned the attack against Sault Ste. Marie Air Defense Sector and the 30th Air Division, flying the tactics that they would fly to attack Russia. So the B-52 bombers came across Lake Superior at virtually zero altitude, so low that they had to climb to get over the coast, south coast of Lake Superior. And we had just a whole rash of complaints from homeowners who said, "A big airplane just flew over my house and nearly took off the shingles," you know, that sort of complaint. The B-58 Hustlers came across Lake Superior at 48,000 feet in Mach 2, twice the speed of sound. The B-47 jamming aircraft flew a pattern we hadn't seen before, which was called a basket weave. So two B-47s and then a bunch of them in a stream were flying like this and dropping chaff, electronic foil that that is picked up by your radar. So you get this huge stream, which looked like obfuscation or clouds on your display. And it was behind that chaff that the B-58s came, and the B-52s at low level. So they were mostly below our radar coverage. The B-58s, the Voodoos and the 106s running against the B-58s would have automatically been put into this front snap attack. So if this aircraft's doing Mach 2, they're told to go as fast. So a Voodoo could do about Mach 1.6, a 106 could do about Mach 1.8, close to Mach 2. The overtake now is Mach 4 or Mach 3.5. The airborne radars of the day and the airborne computer fire control systems did not have fast enough computational ability to compute the intercept. So they go into what they call a time compression abort. The radar aborts the run because it says, I can't compute. It's in effect like your computer locking up. Interestingly, the lead sleds, as I used to call them, the F-89Js, an old, much older fighter, capable only of subsonic speed. Maximum they could do is probably Mach 0.6 or something like that, or maybe a little higher. Flying against the B-58 Hustler, Hustler's doing Mach 2, but they're doing less than Mach 1. They had the same fire control system as the Voodoos, but they're not doing supersonic. So their radar was able to compute the intercept, and the MB-1 missile simulated launch and estimate from all the testing computers that are on board, they got a number of kills against B-58s. I was subsequently part of a big trial to find out why none of the Voodoos could complete their intercept, because they all got time compression aborts and so did all the 106s. And it was found to be, we did what we call the trials, dry martini trials. And this is where we deliberately ran targets against supersonic targets in that mode to see what was happening. And it resulted in an upgrade of all the fire control systems to improve the speed of the computations so that they could compute high speed approaches, you know, at Mach 4 and so on. So that was just another interesting part of what I was involved in at the time. Strategic Air Command, of course, their tactics of the day were all top secret and no foreign, which means no foreigners can see them. It's purely U.S. eyes only. Despite that, I was given a special clearance to go to Barksdale, Louisiana, 8th Air Force headquarters to participate in the SAC debriefing of the success of their mission and explain to them what we saw from the radar business. Even though I was a Canadian, I was allowed into the inner sanctum and for their debrief. But I had to have a special access clearance for that, which is a special access clearance is above top secret. It's strictly need to know. I would never normally had the need to know, but SAC wanted to know what I saw and what I had evaluated, because I was an observer. I wasn't actually running intercepts. I was one of the evaluators. It was quite an interesting time. Quite proud of being able to do that. Okay, that's all I have, I think. Just as air traffic